Hello, I'm Dawn Richardson, and today I'm going to be talking to you about a project where we looked at social mobility and engaged Mexican-American youth through participatory photo mapping. Yesterday I presented more specifically on the method. I will touch on some of the methodology today, but really wanted to focus more on the findings and the engagement process today. And I really want to highlight my co-authors down here, Kimberly Duras and Vanessa Gonzalez. They're both undergraduate researchers who work with me on this project. Both of them had midterms this week and were not able to be here, but they are here in spirit. I have no relationships to disclose. So just to be clear, when we talk about social mobility, what we're talking about is moving up or down social class or across the social gradient. And the reason we're focusing on this with this particular group is that Mexican-American second generation, so those are the children of Mexican immigrants born here in the U.S., they experience real disparities in social mobility. And the indicators we're primarily focusing on here are low rates of educational attainment, high rates of poverty, high rates of incarceration and early childbearing, and a disproportionate residence in disadvantaged urban neighborhoods. And the reason that we want to focus on social mobility is that it's really ultimately a social determinant of health and health disparities. And this group of young people is very much interested in the role of neighborhood and how social mobility can really shape the types of neighborhoods you end up in, which can ultimately then impact your social mobility and your ultimate health outcomes. And the reason that we are very interested in neighborhoods is because youth outcomes are very much linked to neighborhoods, particularly neighborhood-level poverty and race-based residential segregation. And social mobility, as we know, is very tied to spatial mobility. So people are going to be stratified into different neighborhood spaces based on a number of social factors. And what that means then is people have differential access and differential exposure to opportunity and ultimately mobility. When we look at second-generation Mexican-Americans in particular, there are some really concrete factors that sort of predict where they're going to end up, the types of neighborhoods. And these really boil down to parental capital, and we're talking about educational capital, financial capital there, parental legal status, the types of discrimination, racial and ethnic discrimination, and structural racism that they encounter, and the types of networks that they're tapped into. We see very clear networks that link folks coming from Mexico into specific neighborhoods, into specific regions, and those networks are create a lot of pull to certain areas. So not to go into too much detail here, given the time that we have, this is a conceptual model, actually, that I've used, that I've modified based on, when we have the author right here, Amy Schultz, and Ana Diaz-Rue. Another article. And what I just wanted to highlight here is that immigration context is ultimately a fundamental factor that is very influential for where people end up and the types of physical and social environments to which they are exposed, which really does then drive the types of health outcomes that we can see. So that's really just the take home of this. So we know a lot about social mobility, and we know how social mobility relates to health, but there are still some real gaps in our knowledge, and these really revolve around how youth experience mobility and how youth experience neighborhoods. And also sort of exploring the need to explore the role of participatory spatial and visual methods. Photo voice, for example, is a method we know is fantastic for engaging youth and for, well, engaging communities in general, but particularly youth, and also providing links to very clear policy interventions. But we haven't used these types of methodologies in examining social mobility, for example. We also wanted to look at the impact of engaging in this way on youth. So the youth who were involved in this, the undergraduate researchers, came onto the project because they were interested in looking at social mobility of Mexican-American youth in Portland. As we developed the project over the first term, they began pointing out that their engagement in the project was also potentially a form of social mobility, and so we added this secondary component, I hope that's clear what I'm describing there, to the project, because as they were, you know, reading the literature and learning about the methods, they realized that they too were experiencing, or potentially could be experiencing, mobility as a function of being engaged as researchers on the project. So the study, the aims are to identify those neighborhood characteristics that youth felt were supportive of mobility but also were barriers to mobility, to have youth reflect on and engage in sharing their mobility experiences and the strategies they use for upward mobility, and then to develop some really concrete policy strategies and recommendations. And so the methodology we used is participatory photo mapping, which is a mixed method blending neighborhood assessment using GIS, photo voice, and participatory mapping. And our participants, so these are the research participants. We had 25, 18 to 25-year-olds, 11 women, 14 men. These are all second-generation Mexican-American youth in the Portland, Oregon metropolitan region. So again, this is the focus of the study was very much to engage youth, and so there was some real intentionality behind that. I wanted to point out the mechanism of funding. This is a project funded by the Stanford Center on Poverty and Inequality, and one of the stipulations that they placed in the funding was that youth be engaged as researchers. They specifically wanted undergraduate researchers, so the funding carried with it the stipulation that we would support up to 3 undergraduate researchers, which was really a huge benefit, because at my institution there's, I wouldn't say pressure, but there's definitely a sense that it's very important to support the graduate students, and so being able or being required by your funder to support undergraduate students created a nice opportunity there, that mandate. So with the funding, with the methods, so intentionally using participatory mapping and photo voice, and then in focusing on having youth researchers of this community, from this community, driving the process. So again, I already presented on the methods yesterday, so I won't go into depth here, but just to point out, this is a mixed methodology combining 3 methods, allowing us to collect spatial, visual, and qualitative data. We used, again, photo voice. The cameras were GPS equipped, so we had photo locations that we were able to then locate on using our GIS database that had a number of neighborhood indicators, poverty, employment rates, access to schools, transportation routes, et cetera. And I'm happy to talk more about the methods if you have questions about that. So some of the themes that emerged, these really fell into 2 areas, you know, those barriers and those mechanisms that we talked about. So I'll take a moment to talk about these. First barrier, uneven distribution of opportunity. All of the youth were very, very, very conscious and very clear about how they saw opportunity being distributed across the area and how and why some had access and some didn't. And there's so many, as I know everyone feels this way, there's so many great quotes and great photos you can share, but this is the one they elected to share for this. So this is a young man living in Northeast Portland. Many Mexican Americans who migrate here don't find a good place to live, and the places you can rent tend to be in ghettos, not good environments to grow up in. That has a part to play in people's success. And what you see here is a type of neighborhood he's describing. It might look nice to the eye, but as you kind of get in there, it's a very high crime, high rates of violence, really poor school type of neighborhood that they were describing and that many of the youth come from that we worked with. Second barrier, the youth called these, you know, cautionary tales or mistakes, immigrant mistakes, and what they're talking about are the mistakes that they would see the choices they would see their families make, their communities make around what to invest in, how to support children, how not to, and again, there are so many ways of sharing this concept, but this is, I think, a fantastic quote. You can play it wrong if you don't know better. If you're not educated enough to know that you're breaking your back, working 11-hour days, getting paid $15, you think you're making bank, but in reality, you're breaking your back, and in 5 years, you're going to be done. And this is specifically related to 2 areas of work that a lot of the Mexican immigrants do in this region. One, just east of Portland, we have a pretty large agricultural area where we have a lot of orchards. So a lot of people are drawn to that area to basically work in harvesting and picking in the orchards, and they make $15 an hour, roughly, and that feels to many families like a lot of money. But a lot of that money then has to go back into the orchard. If you work in the orchard, you're forced to rent a cabin, and it really is a cabin that people live in, with all that brings up for you. And they're forced to rent those if you want to work in the orchard. So it's very much of the, you know, old company town type of format. So you're making the money, but then you're paying it in. You also have really limited access to, you know, grocery stores, for example, so you're paying these high prices. And some of the youth were pointing out that because of that, people haven't taken that money and used it to buy a home or to build up some kind of financial capital, and they see that with lots of their family and friends. And then the other area is like just working in fast food industry or something like that, and pointing out that if you knew better or if you were smarter, you wouldn't make these mistakes. And so as a result of that, one of the biggest mechanisms that we see that the youth shared is the avoiding of that mistake. And so here's a photo, and I just realized you can't see it probably with the lighting in here, but you have Mount Hood in the background, and in front of it is a huge orchard and a barn. And what you don't know is this photo is being taken from a, for lack of a better word, I guess, an upscale, nouveau craft beer restaurant, brew pub, that's positioned to oversee these orchards. And a lot of the youth end up working there in the kitchen, but also, you know, after working, some of them working in the orchard, they'll go here maybe, you know, to have a beer. And so if you can imagine, you're sitting here in this fancy brew pub having craft beer, looking at the orchard that you just maybe were picking from, and what that would bring up for a lot of them. And so this is a quote from one of them who was sitting here taking this picture, and she says, "Every time I was picking, that would be a lot of motivation for me to leave Hood River. I hated working like that all day in the sun. It's really hard work and motivation for me to try hard in school." The other mechanism, and this was ubiquitous across all of our participants, they all spoke to the transit system in Portland. There's a youth bus pass that basically allows any youth in school up until high school graduation to ride any of the MAX trains, the TriMet, anything in Portland that is public transportation for free. They lose that pass when they graduate, and so it creates a bit of a barrier for some of them in going to college, but so there's a lot of movement to sort of extend that beyond the ages of 18 when they graduate. But all of them spoke to this being absolutely essential to their ability to travel for work, to travel for job, for their volunteer positions, to access any of their networks, school, etc. And last, and this is to me, I think, one of the most interesting findings that they spoke about, this very strategic approach to volunteerism and networking. So many of the youth talked about the need to give back to their communities because they felt like their ability to be mobile had come at the behest of someone who'd sort of reached down, as they would put it, to help them up, and they felt the need to do that. But they also really spoke about how volunteering is, for them, a strategic way of making connections, finding mentors, finding ways to connect with people who can then connect them with opportunities. And so it was just this really interesting cycle there. This quote is from one of the young women who was engaged as a researcher, who then became a participant in the project. And it was she, along with four of the others, who noticed, like I was saying before, that being engaged in the project was actually creating some mobility opportunities for them. For example, just through some of the faculty we had involved in training them on how to do qualitative research, for example, different seminars that people would come in, they developed relationships, and some of these people then offered them jobs and scholarships and letters of recommendation and things like that that they may not have had access to other than, you know, the chance of being in this project. And what she says here is, as a participant, I had to look at my environment through a different lens. It was a very empowering feeling. I felt that I could speak for many others based on my personal experiences and being a direct member of the community that the research question revolved around. When I told my family about the project, they thought it was an incredible idea and were amazed that anyone else could take an interest in issues that people like my parents face on a day-to-day basis. My dad even wanted to take part in the project and help with recruitment for the focus groups. Her parents are actually orchard workers in Hood River. So the findings, just to summarize, neighborhood characteristics, one of the big ones is that poverty functions as a barrier, but because it allows youth to sort of see that cautionary tale that they kept describing, and that's not my term, that is theirs, cautionary tale, that it actually promoted a lot of mobility, at least for these youth, and this really heavy emphasis on transportation networks being essential. The experiences and strategies, again, noting and really internalizing and avoiding those mobility mistakes, that strategic networking that we talked about. And one of the really interesting thing is that the youth are experiencing mobility at a very local neighborhood level. So community centers, parks, schools, churches, all of those networks occur at a very local neighborhood level. But all of those mobility pathways are really shaped at a regional level. So transportation, for example, the policies and funding and planning for transportation is all regional in our area, but it's experienced locally. So when we think about the policy strategies and recommendations, almost all of the policy strategies really point to our friends in planning, our colleagues in urban planning. And so some of the policy areas, and I should say my two grad students that work on this project are both Masters of Urban Planning students, so we are well positioned to move forward in these policy areas. And these are identified by the youth based on a number of conversations we've had about the findings and bringing in other faculty and thinking through what sorts of policies are in the mix right now that we could get engaged with moving forward. And these sort of all focus around land use and zoning, and certainly transportation, education, employment, and criminal justice, I won't go into a bunch of detail. There's a lot here. But just to show that there are some very clear points at which we think we can start to partner with community members. And also there are some great organizations in Portland moving forward some of these policy areas currently. So we just got some additional funding to continue supporting the youth. We had planned to do a community forum actually right when I was having a baby, and so that has been delayed, and we are going to be doing that starting in January. We want to continue engaging these youth and supporting them. We very exciting at Portland State, we just received a $24 million NIH training grant to focus on bringing diverse underrepresented students into the university and training them to focus on a research career pathway, primarily focused on the social determinants of health. And a lot of the youth we work with are already sort of part of some of these bridge programs, that this is going to give them some real support in doing that, and really focusing on those relationships with the community colleges in our area, so bringing in more students just like these to do this work. And again, working with our policy partners in the Portland metro area and continuing to do trainings with youth. We did a lot of trainings, like I said, around qualitative data, data collection, research ethics, CBPR, photo voice. We also want to start training them now on actually doing the GIS. So the way the GIS mapping works now is they would work with my grad students, tell them, you know, what to put where, but we'd actually like to train them and build their capacity to work with GIS mapping as well and policy training. All right, so I just want to acknowledge again the funder, Sanford Center on Poverty and Inequality, my co-authors, Lori Parks and Haley Pickus. These are actually my co-authors for the methods paper. The co-authors for this paper are Kimberly Darris and Vanessa Gonzalez, our undergraduate student researchers, and of course want to acknowledge our just incredible and fantastic research participants. They're just a real, you know, joy and opportunity to work with. So here you go. This is a photo of some of our research team and my contact information if you have any follow-up questions. Thank you.